Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRoche Show. We have a returning guest for you. We are joined today by Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Research. In this episode, Lynn shares her macroeconomic outlook and why we are moving into fiscal dominance, where inflation will be more persistent. We also got into the widespread performance gaps in asset markets, why there will be an opportunity in energy and commodities, why gold still has more room to run, and why Bitcoin has even more room to run over the next 2 years, and why she wouldn't be surprised if we saw a six-figure price level on Bitcoin. I really enjoyed this conversation with Lynn. I learned so much from her, and I know you will too. Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy and also author of the new book, Broken Money. It is great to welcome you back on the show. And Lynn, great to see you again. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to have you back. And I got to say, Lynn, the audience always requests you, and I absolutely love that. And I loved having you on, and I hope to get you on more often because I know they love hearing from you. And a lot's transpired since we last had you on. So let's start where I always start with my guest, and that is to get their big picture macro view, the framework in which they're looking at the world today. And again, one of the things about this show, Lynn, take all the time you need to when it comes to setting that table for the macro picture.
Sure. So I think the two big backdrops, one is fiscal dominance and one is bigger than normal differences between sector performance because of that fiscal dominance. And so let's start with the prior one, basically the fiscal dominance aspect. Throughout most of people's like investing time horizon, say the past 40 years, the majority of kind of new money creation, new credit creation has come from the private sector, meaning that the total of new bank loans and new corporate debt issuance in a given year is a bigger sum than the amount of, like, say, federal fiscal deficits, for example. And so even though those are both kind of adding to the overall kind of debt in the system and money circulation, the private sector side has historically been bigger most of the time. But ever since the global financial crisis, and especially ever since, you know, the past 4 years or so, the fiscal side has grown much larger. And so the annual fiscal deficits are bigger than the sum total of you know, most categories of private sector loan and bond issuance. And so what that means is that some of the normal cycles that were associated with investing over the past, you know, 40 years or so are turned on their head a little bit because there's this much larger and less cyclical fiscal component on top of it. And so some of the normal indicators people look at for recession or reacceleration are distorted a little bit because they have this bigger force pushing up against them. And the second point is on sector, like kind of wide performance gaps between sectors. You can have some sectors that are an outright like depression, let's say office real estate, you know, commercial real estate broadly. And then you have other sectors that are doing fairly well. And it largely comes down to whether or not those sectors are on the right side of fiscal policy or the wrong side of monetary policy. So because the US is running rather tight monetary policy, but very loose fiscal policy, that means that sectors that are more sensitive to monetary policy, like, you know, ones that are highly levered, for example, they're going to have a rougher time than ones that are more sensitive to fiscal policy. You know, various companies that are less levered and more reliant on, say, upper middle class spending, for example. And so you have people looking at data expecting a recession, other people looking at other data expecting reacceleration, for example. You have very different outcomes depending on where you're looking in the economy. And I think one of the things we're seeing now is somewhat of a rotation. So some of the tech stocks, for example, are showing weakness, you know, Apple and Tesla and things like that, while at the same time we have energy seemingly trying to break out of a, you know, call it 2-year consolidation. And I think that rotation probably has legs to it. But basically, that's how I'm examining the economy, is one, through this fiscal lens, and two, trying to take every sector independently, or at least, you know, several sectors in a group and kind of analyzing that group versus trying to take the economy as one big Boolean outcome. Like, is the economy good or bad is a really broad question compared to how is this sector compared to this sector.
That is such a fascinating framework, and I love the way you framed it up. Let's start with the fiscal dominance, because this is a topic that has come up on this show. We had Dr. Charles Calamiris, who wrote a paper with the St. Louis Fed on fiscal dominance and an inflation tax. Luke Grohman, this was a topic that came up when he was on the show. Can you help folks understand fiscal dominance, I guess, in a very easy to understand way, and the implications when you move into fiscal dominance?
Sure. And there's a couple different ways you could describe it. They all kind of point to basically what I said before, that the fiscal spending is a bigger macro variable than most other variables in the economy. And that basically that becomes the dominant force to analyze in terms of directional outcomes for things like nominal GDP or inflation, or what sectors are doing better than others. Basically, that the fiscal spending side is dominating compared to other variables. That's kind of the broad idea. More specifically, there's a couple things we can identify about that. One is that it's important to keep in mind that federal interest expense is income for someone else, right? So the government is paying that out, but that's going to those that hold the treasury bonds. And that is spendable income. And so, for example, if you were let's say you're an upper middle class investor, you have a mortgage, you have the only kind of liabilities you have are these long-term debts, mortgages, 30-year fixed rate mortgage, and you have a significant amount of, say, money market funds. And as the Fed raises interest rates, your mortgage is locked in, but your money markets are paying you more now. And so that's actually spendable income. Ironically, the tighter the Fed tries to get, the more you're getting stimulated. Now, obviously, not everybody's in that situation, but a good chunk of spending dollars are from people and companies that are in that situation. And a lot of companies did the same thing. They termed out debt very long term, and then they hold cash equivalents. And so as we kind of blow out interest expense to very high levels, that's ironically stimulatory for some areas of the economy, even though the Fed is doing that because they're trying to actually slow down the economy and slow down inflation. And so the way I would describe it is that when you have a low public debt environment, like for example, the 1970s, most of the new money creation was coming from the private sector, and federal debt to GDP was something like 30%. So if the Fed raises interest rates, this is not a fiscal dominant environment. If they raise interest rates, they slow down private sector bank lending. Although they do increase public sector interest expense, that's a much smaller impact than the downward pressure they're putting on the private sector bank lending. But if you fast forward to the current time where we have 120% federal debt to GDP and deficits are larger than the sum total of bank lending and corporate bond issuance in a given year, then when you raise interest rates, you might slow down that private sector issuance to a similar degree, which is happening, but the upward pressure you put on the federal interest expense is even bigger in total dollar terms than the downward pressure you put on the private sector. It's kind of the opposite scenario of the 1970s. And so that monetary tightening is not as restrictive as it would be if we were in a different environment with lower public debt and more private sector money creation. And so because of that, the Fed's tools for slowing down inflation are weak because they're not really meant to address the fiscal side. They're meant to address bank lending and credit issuance and things like that. They're not really meant to deal with fiscal-driven inflation. And so in that context, fiscal dominance means that the Fed does not have that many tools to directly deal with the source of inflation that's happening. And probably the last way I would characterize it is that we've had 40 years of rising debt to GDP in the United States, but it's been offset by 40 years of structurally declining interest rates. And so, for example, if you double your debt levels, but you cut your interest rate in half, your interest servicing costs are still basically the same. And that's what the federal government's been in for a multi-decade period. And that's what lulled people into a sense of that the public debt doesn't matter because, you know, people have been saying it matters and then it's not mattering. The problem is that when interest rates finally hit zero and bounce off zero and start going sideways to up, and that debt to GDP is still climbing, then that 40-year offset is now reversed. And so that's why we're getting into a situation where interest expense is blowing out so much, because raising interest rates when you have high public debts is a very different environment than raising interest rates when you have a low public debt. And so that's multiple of those kind of answers together is how I would describe fiscal dominance.
That was amazing. Okay, so a couple more threads I'd like to pull on here. Does that mean, so the Fed's tools for slowing down inflation are weak. So when you think about it, does that, you know, 2% inflation target, does that just kind of not seem realistic? Are we going to move into more of a macro regime of persistent inflation, maybe above the 2%? Would love to hear your thoughts there, how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, so my base case is that in the 2020s, we'll have higher highs and higher lows of inflation than we had in the 2010s and say the 2000s and the 1990s, for example. We've already obviously seen much higher high than we've seen since the 70s. Right now, we're kind of testing the bottom of that range. Inflation official is around 3%. It's relatively sticky at that level, the way that they measure it, which, you know, that overall kind of the quality of the measurement is a whole nother discussion. But the way they measure it, it's getting fairly sticky around that 3% level, partially because energy inflation is somewhat reaccelerating from these levels. So yes, my base case is that 2%, while they might be able to touch it from time to time, it's going to be hard to make that the symmetric range that they're aiming for, given the fiscal backdrop they're dealing with. Now, if you get massive energy supplies coming online or AI is, you know, super deflationary, they might be able to offset some of the fiscal driven inflation that we're seeing. So you could have wider than normal gaps between different areas of inflation, for example. Kind of like in the past few decades, you had a very wide gap between services inflation and goods inflation. So cheap goods coming out of China, for example, or electronics getting exponentially better per unit cost. Those things were rather disinflationary, whereas things like hospital services or anything that requires a lot of domestic human labor, childcare services, for example, these things were going up at a much faster rate of inflation. And so I think you could see a rotation in some of those categories this decade. But my overall view would be, yes, higher average inflation, still cyclical inflation, but higher average inflation this decade, largely because of this fiscal backdrop.
Hey there, I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. And then another thing that was so interesting in your prior answer was, you know, the tighter the Fed is, the more you're getting stimulated. Now, it's not for everyone getting that stimulation, but a good chunk, and that was kind of the irony. And I thought that was really interesting. Can we flesh that out a little bit more? And maybe a follow-on I want to tack on to that is, gosh, you have to imagine like who owns the assets or has the exposure to the money market funds who could be benefiting from that kind of like ironic stimulation. Is that, I wonder if there's more of, does that create more of like a wealth divide? I don't know if that's even a good question, but just curious there.
I think it does. I think that's kind of why you see very different economic indicators out there. Because whether or not you're on the right side of that fiscal situation determines how well you're doing. And so basically, there's permanently more money in the economy now. And so people reliant on wages for income, many of them are having a very tough time because even though they did get higher than normal wage increases in nominal terms, it's been challenging to keep up with the cumulative inflation that's happened to things like grocery prices, to things like insurance prices, to all these different categories of goods, especially housing prices. You know, you have higher prices, but also higher mortgage rates. Housing affordability is a challenge for a lot of people. And so that's a segment that's not doing particularly well. But those who do have a lot of assets, basically, ironically, what the Fed's doing is paying them a lot of extra money to not lend. That's essentially how these higher interest rates work. They're paying banks to try to slow down their lending. They're paying, in general, that money's flowing out. And so there are people that are receiving that. And that's, the way that most of this wealth distribution works is that's fairly concentrated. The large money market holders, the large T-bill holders, a lot of that is kind of concentrated in, very cash-rich corporations, very cash-rich individuals. And so they're getting more on their dollars than they were in a low interest rate environment. And so if you're in a situation where you termed out your debt long term and your cash equivalents are obviously much shorter, they're adjusting upward with tighter monetary policy. Whereas the federal government's obviously, like, ironically, in kind of the opposite situation. Their average debt maturity is only like 6 years. They do a lot of short duration funding. So a lot of their financing is under 2 years. And then they have this longer term that extends out to 30 years. But they're very front loaded in the financing that they do, which is different. If you look at, for example, a company like Coca-Cola or any kind of blue chip corporate, corporation, they're going to have on average pretty long duration debt. They term it out as much as possible. There's historically been a lot of demand for their bonds, whereas the federal government's not done that. And so a lot of this capital flow is flowing toward entities that have termed out their debt at pretty low fixed rates, but then have decent amounts of cash equivalents that they're actually earning higher yields on. And while that has a non-zero propensity to spend, meaning that that money, when they receive it, generally won't circulate in the economy as fast as like a stimulus check will. It still has a non-zero propensity to circulate around the economy. And that represents buying power, even as it represents a big fiscal drag for the government. And that's why that can be in a kind of nominal sense, more structurally stimulatory, and a big chunk of that stimulation is the inflation component. So if you're on the right side of it, it feels good. If you're on the wrong side of it, it can feel pretty devastating.
Yeah. And I also imagine too, like, you made a comment earlier about analyzing the economy, and it's not like, okay, you can't say, is it good? Is it bad? I guess there's different pockets of the economy. How do you assess the economy today? Is it a healthy economy? Maybe that's not even the right question, but how do you kind of think about the broader economy today?
So over the past couple of years, we've seen a huge slowdown in some of the more cyclical sides of the economy. So for example, I like to look at PMIs, Purchasing Managers' Indices. It's kind of a big overall read on the rate of change of the manufacturing sector and some of those other cyclical sectors around it. That has been in a very long, drawn down deceleration. And for a period, it was outright contracting. You know, if you just isolated that segment of the economy, that was in recession. And that was offset by a fairly strong services economy. So travel was booming. Restaurants were doing pretty well. Various financial services, various other types of services were generally doing quite well. And so you had that big gap of performance. And ironically, now what we're seeing is a little bit of a rotation. So some of those services seem like they're starting to exhaust themselves a little bit after a pretty strong period, whereas those PMIs, those manufacturing type of areas seem to be reaccelerating. They're still at a pretty low level, but they look similar to how they look when they're emerging from recessions or emerging from near recessions. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see that the next, call it 18 months is kind of an opposite story of some of these more cyclical areas kind of outperforming expectations, while some of these other areas that have done well over the past 2 years start to lag. And we see that in, for example, there's weak EV sales, electrical vehicle sales. There's a little bit of weakness happening in restaurants now. There's a little bit of weakness around the margins in some of these higher end categories that have been doing quite well. And a little bit of that rotation that's happening. That's kind of the main lens that I see it. We see it somewhat similar out of China. That's obviously another big macro impact on the global economy. They've been fairly weak for the past couple years, but they are showing kind of early green shoots, kind of early signs that they might be stabilizing at these low levels, largely because of their policy shift. And so I think that some of these cyclical areas, whether the U.S. or elsewhere, are probably starting to turn up even as other areas soften.
Mm-hmm. And as we turn to asset markets and just looking at the performance, even like year to date, stocks up, gold up, Bitcoin up, I think sometimes it's surprising that some of these asset classes have gone up, I guess, in tandem. What do you make? Let's talk about asset markets. We'd love to just get your assessment there. You were mentioning like these wide performance gaps within the equity markets, but let's just kind of start with asset markets, what you're paying attention to. What do you make of the movements we've seen this year?
I would say that the rise in gold, even despite the fact that rates are this high, including, official measures of real rates being this high, has been kind of very powerful. I think it's one of the been the biggest dislocations in recent years, and that's indicative of fiscal problems. I think that that supports the fiscal dominance narrative. You know, for most investors, if you showed them the PMI chart that I mentioned before, that's basically like a sine wave of cyclical economic activity. And normally, when that's going down, bonds are doing quite well, meaning that their yields are falling and their prices are going up. So generally, if you just over the past 40 years always bought bonds when PMIs were falling and always bought stocks when PMIs were rising, that would not be a terrible investment strategy. And yet what we saw over the past couple of years was as the PMI fell, bond yields went up, meaning bond prices sold off. Bonds acted very differently to how they normally act in a kind of when the cyclical side of the economy is weakening. And I think that's largely because of how much issuance has been coming to market, meaning how large those fiscal deficits are and how sticky inflation is, partially because of those fiscal deficits. And gold has been kind of sniffing that out, or the gold market, because normally when you get those that sharp burst higher in yields, you would normally expect more gold weakness. But I think the market's seeing through that the federal government's kind of in a fiscal tailspin, meaning they don't have a lot of levers they can pull to get overall interest expense down and to get their budget deficit kind of more under control. And so I think that some of these real assets are holding up better than we'd expect based on the things they normally correlate with, because they're forward-looking enough to see kind of how trapped some of those markets are. So stocks up, Bitcoin up, gold up, despite fairly high bond yields, is kind of indicative of investors not really wanting to be in the bond market and kind of going into a variety of other asset classes. I do have concerns around some of the equity valuations because, for example, there's been what investors perceive as a flight to safety. So, for example, Costco is an incredible performing company. They grow like clockwork, very smooth, very high performing compared to their category. But investors are paying like 50 times earnings for Costco. And it doesn't really have the growth to normally justify that type of valuation. That's way higher than it normally has as a valuation. So it's like investors looking around and saying, I'll buy Costco at almost any price, rather than what I'm seeing in the bond market, rather than what I'm seeing in the cyclical market. And I think that's overdone. So I think the areas that are still kind of interesting from an investor perspective are ones that are not overvalued and haven't really gained a lot of that monetary premium yet. So, for example, the energy sector, I think, is still very cheap. Some of the other cyclicals, I think, are still very cheap, whereas some of those more kind of low volatility growth stocks, I think, are kind of overdone. If I were to guess, I would say gold and Bitcoin, I still think, have quite a bit to run over the next 2 years. But of course, every asset class is any sort of time frame estimate is mostly probabilistic, because you're trying to account what other investors are going to do with their money.
Before we get into Bitcoin, just on the energy stocks being undervalued, an interesting area. This has come up on the show as well. One, is that an area you're positioning in or you want to be in? And what are going to be some of the catalyst for that particular sector?
Yeah, so I am positioned in it. We in recent weeks, we have been seeing somewhat of a breakout in that area, kind of a pretty good trend. I would say a main catalyst would be that rising PMI I talked about. So if you do see a reacceleration in some of that cyclical activity, the manufacturing sector, for example, if you see some reacceleration out of China as well, that should be supportive of energy markets, the demand side. And the supply side is relatively tight. I mean, OPEC has some spare capacity, but they're holding it fairly tight. Overall, I think in the past decade, we kind of burned through a lot of the oversupply period that we had. And now the energy market's more balanced. And so it's more prone to upward shocks whenever you get that more than expected demand. We're also seeing faltering EV sales, for example. And I just think that investors, the narrative is basically out of energy stocks structurally. And yet I don't think the numbers support that at all. So when you look at them, they have, they use the last couple of years of decent energy prices often to strengthen their balance sheets. They paid down net debt, they accumulated cash, for example, they're generating pretty good cash flows. Their valuations are relatively inexpensive for those balance sheets and for those cash flows. There's a lot more capital discipline meaning that when they do get cash flows, they don't just pile them back into the ground and try to grow as fast as possible. They often use that to send dividends to shareholders or buy back inexpensive stock or pay down net debt. And so there's not a huge supply response happening. And so I think just all the conditions are just very different than they were, say, 5-10 years ago. Energy and commodities in general tends to go through these, call it 15-year cycles. And I think the period from, say, 2015 to 2020, that was the big washout in the energy space. I think that was the bottom. And I think that the industry is now recovering. It's more right-sized. Its capital policy is better. And that's not really been reflected in valuations yet. And you get paid to own them. So even if they don't get reflected in valuations for the next year or two, you're getting paid dividends. They're buying back cheap shares. They're strengthening their balance sheet. So if you buy companies that 6x earnings, 8x earnings, 10x, 12x earnings, these are fairly cheap investments. And a lot of that cash flow just accumulates to the investor in various ways. And I think that we are seeing kind of a breakout in price, but I view it as that longer term story of just you're getting paid to own high quality under-owned assets.
Mm-hmm. And my final question before we wrap here, I want to get your take on Bitcoin. And as part of this question, can you give the folks some context? I know you've been writing about Bitcoin, investing in Bitcoin for a long time. So kind of give us the background, your thoughts on Bitcoin's performance this year, I guess in the wake of the ETF approvals and some of the driving forces going forward. Would love to just, you know, keep the question pretty broad, but would love to hear your thoughts in the last few minutes.
Sure. So I've analyzed Bitcoin for quite a while. My first public article about it was in 2017. I initially recommended and purchased it in April 2020. It was during that kind of big crash that Bitcoin and other assets were having. And we're up about 10x from that initial position. So we bought it at 6,900. You know, we've obviously been touching, you know, give or take 70,000 in recent weeks. We kind of touched 69,000 back in the prior cycle in that 2021 period. So it has been a story that you know, I've been focused on for really about 4 years heavily, but longer than that in the broader sense. The way I would describe it is basically a better form of money in the telecom era than we've had. You know, I would describe it as pre-telecom era. So pre-telegraph, you had slow transactions and slow settlements. Ever since the telegraph was invented and widely deployed by the late 1800s, you had fast transactions but slow settlements. And that basically gave a lot of power to middlemen, banks and central banks. And ever since 2009, there's been the invention of fast settlements, basically the internet, bandwidth, cryptography have found ways to basically run a decentralized ledger. So you have fairly fast transactions, fairly fast settlements, and therefore can kind of reduce the amount of activity that middlemen do. Not entirely, but it kind of reduces their monopoly power that they've enjoyed for the past, you know, call it century and a half. And you know, that technology is being tested. People are coming up with all these other versions to see what sticks. For 15 years now, Bitcoin's been the largest, most liquid, you know, kind of simplest, most decentralized cryptocurrency. And I think the network effects are very powerful. In the more cyclical sense, I would say that I think we're most indicators suggest we're roughly mid-cycle in terms of a bull market, meaning that we're pretty high off of the lows that have reached in this cycle. We're around prior highs of the prior cycle. Some of the on-chain indicators are suggesting that there are some longer-term coins coming to market to meet all this new demand from ETFs and elsewhere. And so whenever it gets overbought in kind of the near-term sense, I get kind of cautious. But I do think that Bitcoin likely has higher to run in the next 2 years. And when I look out 10 years, I'm bullish on the asset. So as long as I'm, you know, kind of managing that position size relative to expected volatility or relative to risks or tail risks that I see in that investment thesis, I'm quite bullish on Bitcoin in both the cyclical and the structural sense.
You don't do like price targets, do you, within the 2 year time frame? Or some people do, some people don't.
Yeah, for the most part, no. In the prior cycle, I estimated they would hit $1 trillion market cap, which it did. Then I was like, I could see it hitting 100,000, and it, you know, it didn't quite get up to that level. You know, I would be surprised to not see it hit six figures in this cycle. But of course, anything can happen. You're trying to estimate external demand for it. Another thing worth pointing out is that it's Bitcoin price is historically very tied to measures of global liquidity. And so, for example, if you look at global broad money supply in dollar terms, Bitcoin's historically been very correlated to that. And that, you know, that goes up when either the dollar is weakening or there's a lot of credit creation or money printing around the world. And in the past couple of years, that measure has been consolidating because the dollar index has been fairly high and a number of central banks have been trying to tighten. It reached a low in late 2022, which is roughly when Bitcoin reached its low. It's up off the lows, but it's still kind of in a consolidation. My estimate is that we're probably going to see a positive liquidity cycle over the next 2 years. And so while I'm less confident to forecast a Bitcoin price, I generally try to stick with forecasting probable direction or overall risk reward on a direction. And so I still incline up in Bitcoin price without trying to say what is going to be the illiquid spike high that we see this cycle. I have no idea. I just think that the overall kind of momentum and fundamentals still point up for this cycle.
Noted. Lynn, I have to say, I love having you on. I love listening to you. I love learning from you. I know the audience certainly does. Can I give you the final few moments here to, you know, let folks know where they can find your work, support your work, subscribe to your work, find you on social, and any parting thoughts, anything that you would love to leave this audience to think about? The floor is yours.
Sure, I appreciate that. People can check out Broken Money on Amazon or elsewhere. Then go to lynnalden.com and see all my research articles and newsletters. They can see me on X or Twitter at Lynn Alden Contact. I think the main thing to focus on in the current period is trying to understand that fiscal dominance aspect. I think it's becoming more understood, but it's been something I've really been kind of researching and providing material on for the past several years, and it still, I think, is not fully understood. So I think, you know, going back and kind of trying to make sure you get the concepts of fiscal dominance that I mentioned is basically for the audience. If some of those were confusing, I have articles on it, or you can watch it a couple times. Or you mentioned other analysts like Luke Groman, for example, too, that have been talking about that. You can get multiple perspectives on that. I think understanding that's important. And then if you're an investor in the more cyclical sense, I think trying to figure out if indeed we're getting this rotation that I mentioned is something that's really worth focusing on. So if the rebound in PMIs and things like that has legs to it, and if the slowdown in some of the tech things has legs to it, I think watching for that potential rotation is important.
Well, Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Research and author of the book Broken Money. Definitely go pick up a copy. I will leave a link in the show notes. Thank you so much, Lynn, for being so generous with your time, your ideas, all of your knowledge, and great to have you on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Of course. Thank you.